I'm Jerry, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jerry.
Really thankful for Art to say yes tonight. And I had a feeling he would because I think he always says yes. I don't think he says no to anything. It was probably my third AA meeting that I met Art. He doesn't remember it, and I don't really remember what he said. But I remember being in a meeting, and I was very, very confused. I've heard some talk over here about this, some talk over here about this, and I'm trying to make sense of it all. It was up at 8111. And none of it really sounded like it could exist at the same time. And then Art spoke, and I didn't know who Art was, and he spoke, and I'm like, right, balance. Balance and humility. And when I think of Art, that's what I think of. I just think of a guy that shows what we're supposed to do here. He walks the walk. We're really happy to have him here. Thanks, Art. Appreciate it.
Hey everybody, my name is Art and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Art.
And it's a pleasure to be here tonight, and thank you, Jerry, for inviting me. Before I get started, I think it's traditional to tell a joke. But what I do have is an experience. I'm a lawyer, and a client came into my office to do a will, and we get done with the general parts of the will, and it's all going fairly well, and then I ask him if there's any special provisions that he wants to have inserted, and he said, well, yes, there is. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, when I die, I want 6 pallbearers, and I want 2 to be football players from the University of Georgia, 2 to be football players from Georgia Tech, and 1 player from the Atlanta Braves, and the 1 from the Atlanta Falcons. And I looked at him, I said, well, that's pretty unusual. Why do you want to do that? And he said, well, for 2 reasons. First of all, they're probably up to it, being good athletes. They probably can carry the casket. And secondly, because I just want to be let down one more time. That's not true at all. what it was like, what happened, and what I am like now. I was a kid growing up in a family of 5. The youngest child, and I really didn't want for anything, so I don't know why I'm here tonight. I really don't. None of my family members are alcoholics. I've got 1 nephew who's a drug addict, but that's it. As far as I know in my family history, there is no alcoholism. I seem to get, I'm the chosen one, so. But I did know that from the very get-go, I felt different. I felt alone. I felt separated from other people. And I was totally absorbed with myself. Now, that's okay for a 5-year-old. It's not okay for a 25-year-old. Feeling isolated and alone and full of self is not normal for someone who grew up the way I did. I had a loving family. We had our own quirks, but there was nothing in the family setup that would cause me to become what I am today. When I was a teenager, I started developing depression, and that fed off my feelings of being different and alone. But it was undiagnosed at the time. It wasn't diagnosed until I was 40 years old, by which time I had developed into a full-blown major depression that. Major depressive episode and got hospitalized for it. Not once, not twice, but 3 times. So when we got to step 2 about insanity, I've been certified. I've been certified. But I had delusional thinking from the very get-go. And I don't know if any of you will identify with this, but I thought I had to be perfect. I thought that was expected of me. I didn't know that it was okay to be a kid. I thought that if there was a test, I had to get 100% on it. If there was something that I was supposed to do physically, I should do it perfectly. Now, just to give you an example how far off the mark I was, playing softball as an elementary school kid, I could never understand why I couldn't hit the ball until I finally figured out later on that every time I swung, I closed my eyes. Never made contact with the ball. I was the biggest disappointment. I was the last person chosen for any team. My first episode with alcohol occurred when I was about 13 years old, and I was allowed to drink. We had sweet wine for major holidays, and I didn't so much have the sweet wine as I had a wine cooler or wine mixer. They call it a spritzer at the time. 7-Up and Menashevitz wine. What a great concoction. And there should have been some indication that I had a problem because I finished that one fairly quickly and I asked for another. And I was only 13. It made me feel different. It made me feel good for a change. It made me feel as though that spring that had been wound up way too tight inside of me got a little release. And it was that relief that I got from that first drink that sort of stayed with me mentally. I would experiment on and off a little bit with alcohol growing up. I mean, that's what teenage boys do, especially in high school. They get some warm beer and go out and shoot, at least I did. I shot 22 rifles at little play targets and drank warm beer. And that's how I spent some of my summers. But it wasn't very often, and it certainly didn't become the problem it became later on. My real kickoff meeting for alcoholism was when I went to Germany. I was a senior in college and got a scholarship to go and learn German language. And I don't know if any of you have been to Germany, but the beer they serve there is much different than it is anywhere else in the world. It's like golden silk going down your throat. And I'm not romanticizing, I'm just trying to describe for you what my experience was. With German beer, and I quickly developed a habit of drinking at lunch and drinking at dinner and drinking after dinner, and I pretty quickly phased myself right into an alcoholic behavior. I was 21 years old, and I was, after just a month or two, showing every sign of being an alcoholic. It happened that fast. Now, that some people will tell you that I waited as long as I possibly could until I was, until it was legal. Where I grew up, it was 21 years old to be legally drinking beer. And that happened on my 21st birthday. My dad bought me my first drink, and I liked it. And when I went off to Germany, I kept drinking. When I got back, I went to graduate school and met a woman. We got engaged. And she had a family custom of having drinks before dinner. I don't know how many of you did that, but her drink was martinis, and my drink was scotch on the rocks. And my scotch on the rocks started out as normal and progressed pretty rapidly into eyeballing the shot, and then a shot and a half, and then having a second one. And I was off to the races. That was really where I think I crossed the line. Because I had the typical symptoms. I started watching the clock. Is it 5 o'clock yet? If not, only about 4 o'clock, I started getting that tingling feeling inside me. I wanted to drink. Actually, what happened was I needed to drink. I needed to calm down. I needed to be able to relax. That tightly wound spring. I needed to get unwound a little bit. And that just progressed. Day after day, year after year, my drinking progressed a little more each day. And my ability to say no to a drink evaporated pretty quickly. If there was alcohol around, I drank it. It didn't really matter what it was. Whether it was wine, whether it was beer, whether it was hard liquor, I tried everything. I didn't drink for the taste, I drank for the effect. And the effect for me was to become a normal human being. To be able to say, ah. And I think if you're an alcoholic, or if you're not, if you don't know whether you're an alcoholic or not, if you have a drink and you say, ah, that's a pretty good sign that you have a problem. I developed a denial about my problem. My wife at the time, we had two kids when I was 30, the other when I was 31 years old, or 33 years old. And I didn't realize about it, but my drinking was interfering with everything. It was interfering with my work, my family life, my religious observance, There was one thing I have to admit. I don't think I've ever admitted this before, but it came to me when I was thinking about talking tonight. Was one of the things, you know, we tell ourselves that we'll never do. Well, I told myself I would never go into a synagogue having had a drink, and I couldn't keep that. I went in a couple times, not drunk, but feeling it, if you know what I mean. That is a sin in my view, in my religion. To actually go before God drunk is not something you do, and yet I couldn't seem to stop myself. As I mentioned earlier, I had a major problem with depression. Just talking about it takes me back to some very dark times. Dark times that I couldn't determine whether or not my depression was really from my drinking, or my drinking just aggravated where I was. Whatever it was, by the time I was age 40, I was attempting suicide. I just couldn't deal with life anymore. Everything had become black. Open my eyes, I couldn't see past the next minute. Right, not even that far. And I wanted just to end the agony. So I attempted suicide. My first opportunity, the first groundwork for my recovery was laid in that mental institution. I was there for 45 days, and I didn't want to be there. And I knew I didn't want to be there. And so I learned a couple of things. One is I learned the lingo. I learned what the doctors wanted. I'm not stupid. I learned what they needed to hear. And so I told them what they wanted to hear, and they let me out. And that was a big mistake, because 2 weeks later, I drove myself back to the hospital, admitted myself, and for the first time, I actually wanted help. And that's sort of where we are in recovery. We have to want it. We have to want help. Sometimes we come in here, I think, for the wrong reason. We come in here to get people off our backs. We come in here just to quiet the problems we have in our life. Sometimes we come here, I think, to just stop the noise in the head, just get away from it for a bit. But it always follows us. What made a difference for me is that I wanted this. I wanted to stop. I wanted to stop feeling the way I felt. And the way I felt was that there was no hope for me, that no matter what, things were just going to get worse. Every breath I took seemed to get worse. The blackness seemed to surround me. And two very helpful things happened. Number one is I stopped drinking when I was in the hospital for some reason. I couldn't figure out what it was that they didn't want people to smoke and they didn't want people to drink while they're, I guess the medication they were giving you would interfere with it. But I was separated from alcohol for the first time. I also made a decision that I would accept help. And that helped me more than anything when I got to AA. Help was offered to me, and for the first time in my life, instead of rejecting it, I accepted it. It didn't work. I had electroshock therapy to try to get me out of the depression. I don't know if anybody of you know what that is, but they hook up the electrodes to your head and they stimulate your brain to try to reset it. To reset your brain to normal functioning again. And it worked for me for about a week. And that 1 week gave me hope. Hope that there was a solution. Now, I did fall back into depression, but it wasn't as deep as it had been before. And when they let me out of the hospital, I went right back to doing what I'd been doing, drinking. Because I needed relief from life. That's why I drank. I drank because I wanted to get out of right here, right now. And drinking allowed me to do that. And I went right back to where I left off 2 months before. My drinking, I wouldn't say caused me to make some tough decisions in my life, but certainly it facilitated them. By this time, I was a blackout drinker. I would have a couple of drinks and I would black out. And I wouldn't remember how much I had been drinking. I was still living with my wife at the time, and I was not having a good time with that marriage. She was always on my case for something. My wife was an untreated Al-Anon. So you have an untreated alcoholic living with an untreated Al-Anon, and it makes for some interesting things. One thing she did for me every New Year's Day was I'd come down from sleeping that night before ready to watch football, one of my great passions in life, watching college football games. The bowl games were on New Year's morning or New Year's Day, and I would come down and there'd always be an envelope. For the last 5 years of our marriage, there'd be an envelope on the chair, my chair. And I'd open it up and there was my review for the year. My ex-wife was a college professor, and she was used to writing, and she agreed that that I had problems and that I needed to change, and she didn't have problems and she wasn't changing, and but she suggested marital therapy, and so I agreed that we should do marital therapy, and we did for the next 5 years. The problem with that is every time I got comfortable with a therapist, she wanted to change because she wasn't getting the therapist to say that I was the problem. The therapist kept saying that we both are the problem. She couldn't stand that, so she changed therapists not once but twice. And the third time she came to me to say, I don't want to go to this person again, I said, well, you got one of two choices. You can go back to one of the first two we saw because I'm not going to a new person. And that was one of the first times I stood up for myself. I was tired of the criticisms. I was tired of everything else. I deserved the criticisms. I don't get me wrong. I was not a good father. I isolated a lot. I wouldn't play with the kids because I'd rather drink. And when I drank, I didn't feel like doing anything. So Saturday afternoons, a typical Saturday afternoon for me, was opening the beer cans, emptying about four or five of them from the refrigerator and just vegetating in the living room. My daughter would come in. I had two daughters. One would come in and say, Dad, let's go out and play ball. And I'd say, not today. Well, not today became a regular response to that. I became a terrible father. I was just not engaged with my kids. And that's a pattern that to some extent has continued. I try to be with my kids now, and I'll get into that just a little bit, but it doesn't work. Well, the fifth annual letter finished with the following phrase, a paraphrase, says, I think we should separate. And that, is, to me as an alcoholic, that means quitting or separate. What's the separation? Either we're in it or we're not. See, I was a black and white thinker. I thought we're all in or we're not all in. We're out. We're all out. And so my wife came downstairs before the kids woke up and said, did you read the letter? I said, yes. She said, well, what's your answer? And I said, I don't know. I need to think about it. So I watched football and drank all day. And when the kids went to bed that night, I said, I don't think we should separate. I think we should divorce. And said, don't worry about it, I'll handle it. I'm the big lawyer, right, so I can handle this. And I did. I stayed sober enough to get through the divorce, although when I went to the final hearing before the judge to take the testimony for the divorce, I was drunk. I didn't let on I was drunk. I was pretty good at covering it up. But I'd had too much to drink, and I vaguely remember the court hearing. But I do remember the sense of relief. Well, at least that's over. Now I can drink the way I want to. Part of the thinking about whether or not I should get a divorce was, oh, this will allow me to drink whenever I want. That was part of the actual thinking process. Not what's good for the kids. I had been married for 22 years. What's good for the future. Not what's good for my wife, but, oh, this means I can drink whenever I want. And that's exactly what happened. I quickly went downhill, attempted suicide one more time. Came out of that, lost my job because of drinking. There were 13 items they listed when they brought me in for the separation meeting, and they said, when they announced, when they told me I'd be leaving the company, and the only one I remember, the 13, was that someone had smelled alcohol on my breath in the morning. You see, by that time, I drank a fifth of whiskey every night. Every night. I would stop off at the liquor store. I picked one of five because I didn't want anybody to think I had a problem. So I had a whole routine of five different stores I would go to. Some I doubled up on because I drank 7 days a week and I had a problem with that, but there were five convenient ones. And I would open the fifth. By then I was down to being unemployed. I didn't have a whole lot of money left, so I was into cheap gin and cheap vodka. Cheap gin straight. Not a good thing to do. Cheap vodka straight. The higher the proof, the better I liked it. But I'd have two of those drinks, and then I'd black out. Just two. And I don't remember, but I remember waking up. I remember waking up in the middle of the night, staring at the TV set, which back then, after a certain time of the day, that you got snow. The stations went off the air. They don't do that anymore, but back then they did. And I would be watching snow, and I'd be looking down at the bottle, because I had started in the kitchen with my bottle. By now, the bottle had actually gotten next to me, sitting on the floor, and it was empty. A fifth of 100-proof vodka in the course of about 7 hours. Because I would start about 5 o'clock, and I couldn't stop. This went on for day after day after day. I was by this time unemployed. I got enraged that they would think that I had to be fired. I was just so full of myself, it was incredible. And I was in denial. Still that I had a problem. I kept figuring there's got to be some way that I can drink successfully. I didn't understand people like my brother, who's just a year and a half older than me, who can have a glass of wine or have a beer and say no, that he was done. I did not understand that. That wasn't my experience. For me, one led to another, led to another, led to another. And it was something inside of me that said more. And I had no power over that. Alcohol was my master. One night, I guess I had a moment of clarity. We were supposed to talk about how we found God, and I think this is how I found God in this whole situation. I opened my fifth. I drank the first two. I blacked out. I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning with the usual. I think this television station actually was still on. So I was watching a TV program, evidently blacked out. And I came to, and what happened then was, I think, a God moment in my life. I looked down at that bottle again, and it was empty. And I realized that I was the one who had emptied that bottle. And it really hadn't occurred to me before then. I was pretty dense. I was pretty much in total denial of my problem. By this time, my hand shook so badly in the morning, I had to have a drink. I couldn't even read my own signature anymore. If I didn't have a drink in me, I could not function anymore. I had sweats, my eyes were bugged out, I looked awful, I wasn't eating anymore because it would fill me up so I couldn't drink as much. I started seeing little bugs crawling up the wall. I was delusional, I was hallucinating. And I didn't know that that was not normal. I thought that was just part of life. After all, I'd been in an insane asylum 3 times in my life. I thought it was just more of my problem appearing, but it wasn't. It was all due to alcohol. So I saw that fifth on the floor, empty, and I said to myself, I drank that. I've tried to stop, because I have been trying to stop it, moderate, control, whatever you want to call it. I could feel the internal organs, the heat from them, they were swelling up inside of me. I knew instinctively at that point that I had to stop drinking, and I knew instinctively that I could not. I had come to that jumping off place. What was I going to do? And I looked across the room to a blank wall. Now, you understand, I'm colorblind, so artwork is not my forte. And so I didn't have pictures on the wall. I had kind of a awful-looking apartment that I was living in. And I saw on this blank wall a vision of an old man dumpster diving for food. And right next to the dumpster was a big cardboard refrigerator box that I understood he lived in. And then I understood that that person was me. And I got down on my knees in the middle of my living room floor and I said, I can't do this anymore. And it didn't come up from my head, it came from my heart. And I think it was at that moment that God entered my heart and allowed me to see reality for what it was. That was my moment of clarity, that I was a hopeless alcoholic and that I had no more answers. I had no answers. I didn't know what to do. I tried to moderate, I tried to stop. I could stop maybe for an hour at that point without starting to seize up again. Not everybody gets to that point, but I did. I still had some money in the bank. I still had a place to live. I still had a car that was paid off, but that's it. I had no friends. I had pushed them all out of my life. I wouldn't open the mail because I was afraid of what was inside those envelopes. I kept the drapes closed because I didn't want people looking in, watching me drink. I wouldn't answer the door. My kids, I invited over once a week, and it was a strain to get through those meetings. I cooked dinner for them without burning it, usually. I had no life. My whole life consisted of sitting in a living room drinking. You know how our world shrinks and shrinks and shrinks? Well, this might shrink down to one room. And I was on my hands and knees, and I said from the bottom of my heart, I can't do this anymore. And I didn't know exactly what to do, except I remembered that back in the days when I was actually going to the doctor, he suggested that I go to AA. Because he could see on the test, the blood test, what was happening in my body. I wasn't fooling anybody, really, except myself. He suggested I go to AA, and of course, I did what any good alcoholic does. He lies. Next time I saw him, he said, you go to AA? And I said, yeah, but that meeting is not for me. I just didn't like it, and I don't think I'll be going back. In fact, I'd never been to an AA meeting. I just lied. Lying to me came so naturally after a while that telling the truth would have been better in a lot of situations, but I just lied. And I don't know why. The excitement of lying? I don't know. Just don't know. So the thought came to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did what I thought was the polite thing to do. I found the phone number for AA, and I waited until 9 o'clock in the morning to call because I didn't want to disturb anybody. And I didn't. They were answered the phone on the first ring, and then I got really kind of annoyed because I said I'd like to go to an AA meeting, and the lady on the other end of the line said, "Well, are you an alcoholic or not?" And I thought she was accusing me. of being an alcoholic. All she was trying to do is find out if I should go to a closed or an open meeting. And I thought, I took it as an attack on me. And I said, for the first time to another person, I said, yes, I'm an alcoholic. And that was the beginning of my journey. She said, well, there's a meeting at 8:30. Now, you can probably walk from there, from where you live. And sure enough, it was just a quarter mile away. I, of course, drove my car, parked it in the back of the lot, watching, carefully watching who was entering that door. Because if it was anybody I knew, I was going to drive off. I was too humiliated. I was too afraid of being humiliated to actually go into a room with people that I knew. The lady told me, get there 15 minutes early and go up and ask to speak to the chairman of the group, and they'll take it from there. So I waited as long as I could, 15 minutes before the meeting started. I got out of my car. I walked up to the door. I wouldn't step in, but now remember, this is a church. I'm not a Christian. I didn't want to get struck by lightning going into a Christian church. And I asked to speak to the chairperson, and a guy came out. His name was Arthur. My name is Art. What a coincidence. He'd only had about 6 months of sobriety. He was chairing the meeting that night. And he said, hold on just a moment. I'll get somebody else to help you. And so a guy named, by the name of Pete came out, and Pete became my first sponsor. He said, Art, you never have to drink again. Just do what we do. He did not say, read what we read, think what we think, say what we say. He said, do what we do. And I found to be that the best advice for any new alcoholic. It's a program of action. It's a program of doing. It's a program of taking steps. You're personally taking steps and finding out what the results are in your life. Because I think that everybody has a different outcome. Everybody has a slightly different outcome. One of my first things, well, I can tell you this about my first meeting. I was terrified. I didn't know what was going on. I was kind of frozen. When they asked, Pete told me, he said, they're going to ask at the beginning of the meeting whether there is anybody new here to AA. And he said, you can either raise your hand or not. That's your choice. If you do raise your hand, just say that my name is Art and I'm an alcoholic, if in fact you are an alcoholic. Otherwise, you can just say my name is Art, because you're here to find out whether or not you're an alcoholic. Pete was very smart. He handled me with kid gloves, in a sense. But when I got time to say, my name is Art, I could only say, oh. I couldn't get the word out of my mouth the first meeting. Matter of fact, I couldn't get the same word out of my mouth the second meeting. Because I was new to the group, I raised my hand and I said, I'm Art, I'm an oh. It wasn't until the third meeting that I could actually get the word out of my mouth. That was actually, some of the terror had subsided just enough so that I could say the word alcoholic. I have no problem saying that today, because that's exactly what I am. My first challenge was trusting someone. I didn't trust you. I didn't trust my family. I certainly didn't trust my ex-wife, because she had told my doctor that I drank too much. So I couldn't trust her anymore. She broke that imagined bond between a husband and wife, that you just don't talk about things. And ultimately, I couldn't trust myself. When I was on my knees on that floor, I realized I couldn't trust myself. I couldn't trust myself enough to do what I said I was going to do, and that is stop drinking. I woke up again drunk. And the other thing I realized, going back just a second, was I woke up in the middle of the night, at 2 in the morning, drunk, except I wasn't drunk. I was stone cold sober. Alcohol had stopped affecting me. It just helped my nervous system carry impulses at that point. That's what alcohol really does. It affects your central nervous system. And that's why stopping drinking suddenly can cause death, because your heart will stop. It doesn't know what to do. The central nervous system will shut down. I stopped abruptly. From the moment I was on my knees, I didn't have another drink of alcohol until that first meeting started. And I don't know how I got through that except through the grace of God. I was a serious drinker. I shook violently without alcohol in my system. Matter of fact, when they first brought the cup of coffee to me, they only put about that much in the bottom because I was shaking so much. I two-handed the cup, kind of got down with my face, and got a little drink in. And that's how I drank coffee for the first, oh, 3 or 4 weeks. It took a while to detox. Pete told me, as I said, that I never had to drink again, just do what we do. And he began to show me what to do. He said, we're going to go out for coffee and after the meeting. And we went to a diner and had coffee, and there was some other people. And said, no, Art, just tell them why you're here, why you came to the meeting tonight. And so I broke into my 5 minute. That's all I would allow them to know, 5 minutes of my history. Because I didn't trust people. I thought, if you really knew my weak spots, you would use those against me. And so I didn't trust people for a while. I learned to trust Pete. And that made all the difference. I trusted Pete to tell me the truth. He had been sober for a year and a half. I could not conceive of that. His sponsor had been sober longer than that, and his sponsor, all of whom were members of this group, had been sober longer than that even. I just thought that was fantasy. Pete asked me, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to not drink for a day and celebrate victory and start another day. And I said, I can't do that. He said, why not? He says, I can't possibly not drink for a day. He said, well, what time period do you think you can handle it? I said, about 5 minutes. And that was the honest truth. For me, I had to not drink 5 minutes at a time. Declare victory, go on for another 5 minutes. Sitting on my hands, physically sitting on my hands so that I wouldn't be tempted to reach for a drink of alcohol. I wouldn't be tempted to get up, get in my car, and go get another bottle. I wouldn't be tempted to put something in me. And it became easier over time because I didn't want to lose the agony of time that I went through in the first week. So by the time the second week came around, it was easier for me to say, I'm not giving up the time I've got. I'm not drinking today. At the beginning of my second week, we did the usual thing. And Pete took me to a meeting every day that first week. He said, at the end of each meeting, he said, well, tomorrow we're going to meet at this church at this time. My first meeting was on a Tuesday. My next meeting, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Saturday, he said, I want you to go to two meetings on Saturday. There's a men's meeting in the morning we're going to meet at, and then there's an evening meeting at the hospital we're going to meet at. And the same thing happened on Sunday. I went to two meetings, a morning and evening meeting. A morning meeting was in someone's basement, and the evening meeting was at a church. That's how I stayed sober. I did exactly what Pete told me to do. He said to me, I think you've got step one. I said, when you were on your knees saying, I can't do this anymore, that's really the first step. He said, coming to your first meeting and becoming willing to do what you're told to do was your second step. So we're on the third step. This is my first day of AA. I'm on step three. And he said, I want you to read the 12 and 12, the essay on step three, one sentence at a time. And if you agree with the sentence, you get to go to the next sentence. And if you agree with that sentence, you get to go to the next sentence. and I want you to go through the essay. But if you disagree or are unsure, you got to start over. And that's what I did for the next 3 days, because I couldn't get through the thing without disagreeing and being unsure. Now remember, I was out of work. I had no excuse for not reading this stuff. I could barely read. I was focused, but I was shaking, but sitting on my hands, reading the 12 and 12. And I finally, at the end of the third day, got through the last word of the last sentence. And I'd had a spiritual awakening, because I finally understood that I couldn't and he could. That whole essay made sense to me, and I bought into it. The other thing that caused me a lot of problem was honesty. As I mentioned, I was a pathological liar. I didn't use the word pathological before, but I've come to understand that's exactly where I was. I would lie when telling the truth would be better. And Pete understood this, because I would lie to him and then make amends as quickly as I could. Sometimes it was the next day. My very first lie in AA was going up to Pete, and he said, "Welcome." And he said, "When was your last drink?" And I said, "A week ago." Because I wanted someone to believe that I could control things. In fact, about a month later, I went back to him. I said, "You know, when I told you I had my sobriety date," I said, "That wasn't true. My sobriety date was the first day I came into AA." So I got that clear up. But Pete kind of got tired of the lies. And he said, "Okay, we're going to skip to step 10. There's something called the spot check inventory in step 10. And he said, "Whenever you are dishonest, I want you to pray to have the dishonesty removed. Call and talk about it with someone immediately. Make amends quickly if you caused any harm. And then turn your attention to someone you can help." This was like in my first month of recovery. I was not on step 4 yet, but I was doing step 10, the spot check inventory. And it came about that I'd gotten, after my first few weeks, he said, "Okay, now I want you to go out and get a job." So I interviewed for a job, and I got a job. It wasn't at very much pay. So when I came back to him, I said, "I got an offer for a job, but I don't know, it doesn't pay very much, and I don't know what I should do." He says, "Well, who are you to turn down what God has put in front of you?" So I took the job. Turned out I had a career out of that job, because I got out of myself and I took direction. And it was a job doing leasing work for a company that owned office buildings. And my boss called me up one day and said, "Have you got the so-and-so lease done?" And I lied. Whatever came naturally to me, I said, "Yeah, I've got it done." And so I emailed it out and everything done. The truth is, I hadn't started it yet. So I realized I'd lied, and I called Pete up and I said, "What do I do?" He says, "Did you pray yet?" I said, "No." He says, "Well, just take a moment and pray and ask the dishonesty to be removed from your life." And then he said, "Okay, now I want you to go into her office and tell her that you told her something that was not true." Well, I said, "I'm going to get fired." He said, "Would you rather get sober or have a job?" So I said, "I'd rather get sober." The right answer. I usually give the right answers. And I went in there and I told her that. And I kind of fudged it a little bit. I said, "When you were telling me about this thing, I thought it was something else." So I made a lie to cover the lie. Said, "But it won't happen again." So I got that little project done, and I got it out that night. And 2 days later, the same thing happened. I lied about getting work done. Called Pete up. "What do I do?" He says, "You go in and tell her that you lied." I said, "Well, for sure she's going to fire me this time." He said, "Again, when you came to me, you told me you'd go to any length to get sober. Were you lying then or are you lying now?" And that kind of stopped me, because it was true. I wanted to go to any length to get sober. So I went in there and I told her that I hadn't done it. I didn't lie this time. I hadn't done the work. but I would get it done before the end of the day. And I did. And she kind of gave me one of those looks. Friday, first of Monday, Wednesday, Friday, same thing happened. I'm a slow learner, man. I'm a slow learner. Called Pete up and said, I lied to her again about getting work done. He says, well, you know what to do. And he said, and oh, by the way, make sure you help somebody after you leave her office, no matter what, whether you still have a job or not. Because that's the fourth part of the spot check inventory, turning your thoughts to someone, your attention to someone you can help. And I told her, and she slammed her fist down on the desk and said, don't ever do that again. I didn't get fired. But you know what? I never told a lie again, either. Because the pain of having to make amends for lying was so great. It was easier. Finally, I understood it was easier to tell the truth, no matter what the consequence. And that's what I've tried to do ever since. So that was step 10, when I was on step 3. There was a time a few years ago when I had to call upon this program for help, sincerely call upon it for help. I had been in a business that I invested my life savings in, and it was going south, it was going under. And I stayed with that business for another year, trying to salvage what I could out of it. I exhausted every dime I had in the bank. My life savings, my IRA, everything was gone. And I got down to one day, I looked at my bank account and I had $35 left. That's all I had, it was $35. And here's this big shot attorney who thought he'd be retiring comfortably in his old age. And I kind of said, okay, God, what do I do next? Because I didn't know where else to turn. I did find out, I did realize that a higher power can do for me what I can't do for myself. And sure enough, by some luck, some miracle, some coincidence, I kept getting just enough money to live on. Some of my friends helped me out. Sometimes I got legal work that I could do and earn a few dollars. I ultimately got another job, the same job I hold today. But I want to tell you that, you know, fear of economic insecurity will leave us. That is true. I wasn't afraid of economic insecurity. I had economic insecurity, but I wasn't afraid. Because in my view, one of two things always happens. Whenever there's a problem in life, it's either going to work out or it's going to work out.
Yes.
Happens every time. Just wait. My job is to follow the next right thing and do it. I stay sober today because I work a program, I think, to the best of my ability each day. Some days pretty good, some days not so good. I also do service work. And if you are not doing service work, I can't encourage you how much, I can't stress to you how important that is. My first day, Pete told me, okay, today, this meeting meets again Saturday, and you're showing up at 6:30 because you're making coffee. I thought that was part of the program. I didn't realize that service work was optional. I wasn't told it was optional. I was just told to do it. And so I was coffee maker for the first 3 months of my sobriety. And then they put me on to be secretary of our business meeting. And then they put me on, God forbid, to be treasurer. Now this is a guy who didn't have much money, and I was treasurer of the group. Ultimately, over the course of the next 2 years, I became chairman of the group, its GSR, and ultimately alternate district committee member for the district. I couldn't have done that if I hadn't gotten started early on in sobriety with service work, group service work, and then general service work. Ultimately, I got through the steps. I was 6 months sober, and my sponsor said, it's time for you to start sponsoring others. And I said, I don't think I'm ready to sponsor others. And he said, I don't care what you think. That's the kind of guy he was. And he didn't. He said, don't worry. You can't screw this up. If you don't know the answer to something, admit it and come to me. And together we'll figure out what the answer is for your sponsee. And that's exactly how I sponsor people ever since. I don't have all the answers, but somewhere in this fellowship, there's going to be someone who has identical experience to share, experience, strength, and hope to share. And we just find out who that person is. That's all we do. So I try to continue to be a service to God and the people about me. I think that's probably one of the most useful phrases, to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And that's sort of where I am today. So let me just close with this. And we talk a lot about serenity. In my tradition, there's a word called shalom. And shalom has a bunch of meanings. We use it to say hello, and we say it goodbye. We use it to say goodbye. We greet people with it. Sometimes it's translated as peace, like shalom, y'all. But it has a much deeper meaning than that. Shalom has a sense of completeness, of wholeness, that nothing is missing, that you are a complete person if you are at shalom, at peace, with yourself and with other people. And that's what I've gotten out of AA, and I've gotten that out of our program, and that's what I've gotten out of Reliance of a Higher Power of my understanding. And if there's one thing I could wish for each and every one of you tonight, is shalom. Thank you.